Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Samir Okasha, professor of philosophy at the University of Bristol. His new book, Agents and Goals in Evolution, is just out from Oxford University Press. Biologists standardly treat organisms as agents. They have goals and purposes and preferences, and their behaviors and adaptive traits contribute to the achievement of their goals. This explanatory practice brings evolutionary biology into conceptual contact with rational choice theory from economics, which provides models of how people make decisions and act on them. In his new book, Okasha explores the fascinating and complex links between evolutionary biology and rational choice theory, arguing that agential thinking in adaptationist explanations of non-human organisms is justified by a utility that goes beyond using the concept of function. He also reaches some surprising conclusions that natural selection does not necessarily or even probably lead to the most adapted or fittest traits, and he also considers how and when the idea of utility maximization in economics has its valid analog in the idea of adaptive fitness. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Samir. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you very much.
Really excited to be talking about your book, Agents and Goals in Evolution. It's really a fascinating exploration of the explanatory relationship between evolutionary biology and then rational choice theory on the other. So before we get into the actual nitty-gritty of the book, maybe you can tell us a bit about your own background as a philosopher and how you came to write the book.
Yeah, so I'm a philosopher of science. I did my PhD at Oxford University, finishing in 1998. My interests straddle traditional analytic philosophy and philosophy of science with a particular focus on evolutionary biology, though I've also always had an interest in economics and rational choice. And for a long time, I've tried to sort of operate in, live a sort of dual life between being an analytic philosopher on the one hand and discussing foundational questions in science, in particular in evolutionary biology, on the other. The book was a long time in the making, probably 12 years or so, and grew out of my previous book that was entitled Evolution and the Levels of Selection that I published in 2006. It was, we'll get into the detail in a moment.
Okay, so one of the first concepts that you introduce is this idea of agential thinking, right? That an organism in evolution in biology is treated as an agent with goals towards which its behaviors and its traits somehow conduce in some way. So can you explain a bit about the overall structure of the book, what you're trying to do?
Yeah, so the book is what you might call an exercise in philosophical anthropology, in the sense that what I'm doing is looking at a practice that I see in the science, in the science in question being evolutionary biology, that I find philosophically interesting, and standing back and saying, why do people think and talk this way? So what I claim is that there is a mode of thinking and of talking and of reasoning in evolutionary biology that I dub agential thinking, an expression I actually borrowed from Peter Godfrey Smith, that involves the deliberate transposition of concepts and descriptors that we usually apply to human agents, to rational human agents, such as purpose, belief, wants, desires, interests, that sort of thing, to organisms that we know don't really have those cognitive attributes at all. And this is what I call agential thinking. And there are two broad perspectives one might take on it. On the one hand, you might think that this is just sort of a form of anthropomorphism and is a vocabulary and a language that we could in principle excise from evolutionary biology if we wanted. The second alternative is to argue that, no, there is some deep underlying reason why evolutionists have long thought and talked in this way, and it does presumably correspond to the objective facts in some way. So it's more than anthropomorphism in that there's a systematic and principled reason why we employ this cognitive and psychological idiom to describe evolved organisms and not in other areas of natural science. So those are the two poles, the anthropomorphism pole and the it's a natural way of describing the objective facts pole. And what I'm trying to do is sort of, if you like, steer a middle course between those or adjudicate between them. And the sort of somewhat possibly uninteresting conclusion I get to is that the answer is involves a bit of each.
Okay. So I want to get back to that particular idea of, you know, that pole, the anthropomorphic versus objective pole. But what is an agent? You sort of you described a number of different terms in the, you know, intentional or psychological idiom. Are there particular aspects of the intentional vocabulary that are important here, and then others are not, or are there limits to what counts as part of agential thinking or part of being an agent?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So, the key organizing distinction I begin with in chapter one is between what I call agential thinking of type one and of type two. So when we're doing agential thinking of type one, we're treating an actual evolved entity, paradigmatically an individual organism, as an agent, and we're trying to understand its evolved traits, including but not only its behavioral traits, as strategies or instruments that the animal, that the organism is using in order to achieve that goal. So, for example, its goal might be to maximize its lifetime reproductive success, and a sub-goal might be, therefore, to try and acquire a mate, and its mating display might be an attribute that we use, that we understand as a way of achieving the goal, the intermediate goal of attracting a mate, which in turn conduces to the overall goal of maximizing its lifetime reproductive success. So that's agential thinking type one, where the agent is an evolved organism. Agential thinking type two is a rather different business and involves metaphorically analogizing the process of natural selection itself to a process of deliberate agential choice. So if you like, the agent in agential thinking type two is Mother Nature herself. So we think of the process of natural selection as akin to a process of rational choice in which nature chooses between alternative genotypes or phenotypes according to some criterion. And that's a very different motivation for importing the language of choice, preference, and goal into evolutionary biology than is agential thinking of type one. And in short, one of the key arguments I make is that agential thinking of type 2 is a flawed heuristic applicable only to the simplest sorts of natural selection. But agential thinking of type 1 is a valuable heuristic and is not universally applicable and certainly rests on adaptationist presuppositions, but nonetheless plays a genuine intellectual role in the science, which I try and articulate in the first two chapters.
Okay, so let me, you know, you've talked about it as being a valuable heuristic, even though these evolved organisms don't really have the attributes. But of course, we are evolved organisms too. So how is that, you know, how are you adjudicating that line between when this conceptual scheme, you know, intentional idiom, decision idiom, agential idioms are like, you know, mere heuristics and not mere heuristics, given that we, along with everything else in biology anyway, are evolved.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I suppose I'm, although I don't say this explicitly, I'm adopting what I think is a fairly conventional line on the reality of intentional attributions, in that I'm presupposing a form of intentional realism as applied to human beings. So I'm taking it that the vocabulary of belief, desire, try, purpose, prefers, literally does describe the psychology of human beings, and that it's and possibly other higher vertebrates too, but certainly not bacteria or genes or many invertebrates. I don't see that there's any good way of drawing a hard and fast line there, but I do think it's fairly uncontroversial to say that, for example, if we're considering a bacterium swimming through an oxygen gradient, then we know very well that the proximate cause of its behavior is chemical, not psychological. But nonetheless, we might well say that what the bacterium is doing is trying to reach an area of higher oxygen concentration, for example. So I take it that that's an uncontroversially metaphorical use of the intentional idiom, by contrast with an intentional description as applied to a human agent. Now, I realize that's not the only possible line to take, but I think that's the default sort of common sense position, and the one that I'm presupposing here.
Right, right. Although you mentioned Peter Godfrey Smith, I mean he's done a lot recently with cephalopods, right? You know, invertebrate intelligence, and I wonder to what extent, right, he would agree with that. I mean, you mentioned that it's not clear where the line would be drawn.
No, it isn't, and I mean there are quite serious researchers who entertain the hypothesis that there is such a thing as plant intelligence, so extending even beyond the animal kingdom. I was trying to stay neutral with respect to that issue, really. I mean, I take it that many of the sorts of agential thinking that I'm interested in, as for example, when we say that a worker bee kills the eggs laid by a fellow worker because it prefers that the queen's eggs be reared instead, I take it that that is best thought of and as a metaphorical usage of intentional vocabulary, but I don't have any knockdown argument against someone who says, you know, with Denner, to know all intentional vocabulary is similarly metaphorical.
Right, right, right. I mean, he kind of applies the intentional stance across the board, right?
Yeah, and my project is in many ways owes a lot to Dennett, but I think that particular commitment of his is dispensable and is orthogonal really to the project that I'm engaged in here, which is to understand, you know, why it is that evolutionary biology, without much self-conscious reflection has been so ready to use this language of agency and of goal-directedness and of preference and of strategy as applied to organisms with very limited, in many cases, very limited cognitive capabilities.
Okay. Again, one of the issues that you deal with is an objection, I think, also from Godfrey Smith, that this language actually is dispensable. Could you explain why you think that is incorrect? That it is indispensable in a way.
Well, I haven't used the language of dispensability and indispensability so much as using the contrast between the question, the issue of whether it plays a genuine intellectual role in science and whether it doesn't. And now maybe that amounts to much the same thing. I certainly think that what I call agential thinking of type 2 is dispensable. That's the Mother Nature type of way of thinking in which we treat the process of natural selection itself as akin to a process of deliberate choice between alternatives. And I've argued that that's not a generally valid way of thinking about natural selection, in that it's only applicable to the simplest sorts of natural selection, and is a flawed heuristic indeed. But agential thinking of type 1, where we think of the agent as the individual organism itself, or possibly a group, or maybe a gene in certain circumstances, but paradigmatically the individual organism. Yeah, no, I regard as not something we can simply dispense with, in the sense that we would lose great explanatory power if we tried to. Now, one way I've tried to make that argument more precise is to pose the following question. Suppose we grant that the language of function is legitimate in evolutionary biology, in the sense of selected effect, as philosophers often say. That's when we equate the function of something with its adaptive significance. When we say that the function of the cactus's spines are to deter herbivores, then we simply mean that that's the reason why they evolved. It's because of that they evolved. Now, let's ask the following question. Grant the language of function in evolutionary biology, does the language of agency really add anything to that? If we describe the cactus as trying to deter herbivores and growing spines for that reason, is that really anything other than an unnecessary, long-winded way of saying the function of the cactus's spines are to deter herbivores? And presuming we're happy with the latter attribution and understand, you know, how to translate it into purely causal terms, then one might well say, look, is the language of agency actually adding anything to that? And I pose that question in a skeptical tone of voice, if you like, and then end up arguing that the answer is actually yes, that there is a genuine reason why we use the language of agency and we think of the cactus as an agent trying to achieve something. And similarly for other organisms and their evolved traits, and that it does add something over and above the language of function. And the key to what it adds lies in the concept of unity of purpose that I develop in chapter 1.
Okay, that was actually my next question, was if you could explain this concept of unity of purpose, because it does play an important role kind of throughout the book. So maybe you could say something about that concept itself and then how it figures in your discussion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the basic idea is that talk of agency does achieve something that talk of function doesn't. And the reason for this is that functional talk applies to traits, but agential talk applies to organisms. So that's to say, we talk about the function of a particular trait, but it's the whole organism, not its traits, that has a goal or objective or prefers one thing to another or has interests, etc. And this in turn highlights, I think, an implicit theoretical commitment of agential thinking of type one. And the commitment is this, that the entity that we treat as the agent, typically the individual organism, must possess a unity of purpose in the sense that its different traits must contribute to a single overall goal, namely enhancing the organism's fitness. And I think of this as a kind of evolutionary analog of the psychological unity of purpose that is presupposed, I argue, when we apply intentional vocabulary to a human agent. So that latter point, that the application of intentional vocabulary to a human agent presupposes unity of purpose, is a familiar theme in the philosophy of mind and action. So there the idea is that if we can't make sense of an agent in the sense of finding that their intentions are consistent and that their motives are consistent and that their actions cohere with their motives, then we can't sensibly think of them as trying to do anything or treat them as an intentional agent at all. A familiar theme in the work of Donald Davidson and Dennett, of Christine Korsgaard and Michael Bratman and others in the philosophy of mind and action. And what I argue is that there's a sort of biological analog of that point, in that an analogous unity of purpose is necessary in order for an evolved organism to be treated as agent-like, and is in fact presupposed when we apply agential idioms such as interests and the language of interests and goals, and intentional idioms such as the language of wants and tries to an organism in an evolutionary context. So that's the key argument. And that in turn is meant to illustrate that agential thinking and the agential idiom, as I sometimes write, does do more than the functional idiom in evolutionary biology, in that it rests on this crucial empirical presupposition. And when that presupposition is violated, agential thinking and the use of the agential idiom ceases to be applicable. Can I illustrate that last point?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. I illustrate this with a number of examples. I'll just give one example from the book, and this involves the fruit fly Drosophila and a phenomenon known as sperm killing, which results from a gene on the X chromosome in a number of species of Drosophila pseudo-obscura. Now, what happens in this case is that a particular X chromosome variant produces no Y-bearing sperm at all, because genes on the X chromosome basically disrupt spermatogenesis, so they're sperm-killing genes. And as a result, a fly bearing that X chromosome variant produces far fewer viable sperm than would a normal male. Okay, so then we've got this particular trait, failing to produce Y-bearing sperm. Now, that trait doesn't benefit the fly itself. On the contrary, it benefits the X chromosome itself, or the genes on it. However, other traits of the fruit fly, for example, its mating behavior, are designed to try and maximize its reproductive success. So here we find that the fly exhibiting two traits that pull in a different direction, if you like. One trait, its mating behavior designed to maximize its reproductive success. Another trait, failing to produce Y-bearing sperm, which results in far fewer viable sperm being produced than in a normal male, does not similarly enhance its reproductive success. So if we try and treat the fly as a unified agent, and we try and understand the trait of failing to produce Y-bearing sperm as a means by which the fruit fly tries to achieve its goal, we won't understand what we see. And I think of that as a sort of partial breakdown of unity of purpose, and something that impedes that undermines or prevents us applying agential thinking to the fruit fly. And that's meant to be an analog of the psychological disunity of purpose that, when too widespread, renders inapplicable the use of intentional descriptors in human beings.
Right. Okay. So I guess there's two different directions that I'd like to go into from that. First of all is, the unity of purpose, the whole idea of agential thinking type one applies to the organism, the individual organism in the first instance. But as you also discuss in the book, it has been applied to genes, notably the whole idea of a selfish gene, and also to groups, right? To not just eusocial insects, but also collectives, including human collectives or any other sort of group of organisms rather than individual organisms themselves. So I guess the first question is, how does this apply at both, or does it apply in the same way or with the same heuristic value to both parts of organisms and then groups of organisms? And then the second line of questioning was this analogy you have between psychological unity of purpose, right? The Davidsonian thing about, beliefs and desires cohering with actions, and this is a rational agent. And that kind of implicitly brings in the concept of what rationality is, and so it sort of makes agency essentially or intrinsically rational. And we haven't talked about, you do get to rationality later in the book. So, but I am kind of interested in exploring not just, rationality, but its relationship to the concept of agency, because we haven't yet said that agential thinking necessarily involves, some sort of rationality. So first, the genes and
okay.
So question.
Two questions then. So firstly, about whether we can apply agential thinking to genes and groups as well as to individual organisms, and secondly, the link between agency and rational agency. Good. Okay, I'll take the first question first. So what I'm assuming in the book, and this is, I think, in line with the dominant way of thinking in evolutionary biology, is that for the most part, it's individual organisms that are the adapted units we find. And insofar as agential thinking is a way of implementing the adaptationist program in evolutionary biology, we should expect that for the most part, the entities that are treated as the agents with the purposes and the goals will be individual organisms. And that's indeed what we do find. So that's why I say a number of places in the book that the paradigm instance of agential thinking of type one involves treating an evolved organism as agent-like and understanding its traits, including its behaviors, as means by which it furthers its goals. However, there are certain circumstances, I argue, in which it's legitimate and in which we do in fact find biologists treating entities other than individual organisms as the agents. And I mentioned that the selfish gene tradition initiated by Richard Dawkins and now carried on often under the label of ultra-selfish genes. So these are genes that secure an advantage, a transmission advantage for themselves, despite harming the host organism which they're based. And in fact, I gave an example a moment ago of a gene on the X chromosome in Drosophila that prevents any Y-bearing sperm being produced and therefore enhances its own transmission prospect. And I argue that in one specific case, it can be legitimate and heuristically useful to apply agential thinking to the gene itself. And this is precisely in cases of intragenomic conflict or genetic conflict between genes within an organism. So in short, in that example of the fruit fly, although the unity, the disunity of purpose we get at the level of the organism undermines partially the applicability of the agential thinking to the individual organism, we can, if we want, still apply agential thinking by going down a level in the hierarchy and treating the individual gene as the agent. So that's the sole circumstance, I argue, in which it makes sense to think of genes as agents. Now, of course, as is well known, Dawkins and many of his followers applied their paradigm, at least initially, far more broadly and wanted to argue that all genes could be thought of as trying to increase their representation in the gene pool at the expense of their alleles. But the key difference is that in a case of a so-called ultra-selfish gene or a selfish genetic element, the gene is in conflict with other genes in the same organism rather than in conflict with its alleles in the population. And it's only in that case that I argue that we can sensibly apply the agential thinking idea to the individual gene. When it comes to groups, matters are slightly different. So there I argue that the unity of purpose constraint on attributions of agency basically implies that for the most part, groups of organisms won't be good candidates for being agent-like. And that's a corollary of the widely accepted observation that instances of group level adaptation in nature are fewer than instances of individual level adaptation. And the reason for that is that in a typical group, with some exceptions, perhaps such as honeybees, certain honeybee colonies, for example, in which internal conflict is suppressed, but in a typical animal group, then there may be a commonality of interest to some extent, but we also find enormous conflict. So the group doesn't really act as a single unity, if you like. Rather, much of what we see, we need to understand as individual organisms pursuing their goals rather than the group pursuing its goal. And it's only in cases of extreme group integration, roughly the cases that motivate the descriptor superorganism in evolutionary biology, the controversial description that I think most people would agree is only rarely applicable to groups of multicelled animals. It's only in those cases that we can really think of a group as agent-like. And the reason for that is, again, this unity of purpose constraint.
Okay.
So that's the first question.
Right.
Would you like to talk more about that sort of
thing? Well, I would, but I don't think we should because okay. We'll run out of stuff. I do want to get to the rationality issues and other things.
Right. Okay, so then you had a question about whether, as I use the term agency, it presupposes rational agency. And it's a good question. So one thing I do in chapter one is distinguish between three notions of agency that we find in philosophy and in science, or three rationales for applying the language of agency to individual organisms. But I mean, as regards the concept of agency itself, I start by describing what I call the most minimal notion of an agent. And this is simply that of an entity that does something or behaves, if you like. So here I'm drawing on Fred Dretske, who argues that there's an intuitive distinction between an agent, an entity that does something, and something happening to that entity. So if a rat moves its paw, that's something the rat does. But if a biologist moves the rat's paw, the dead rat's paw, that's something that happens to the rat, not a behavior of it. So just that basic point defines a minimal notion of agency, I think. However, In philosophy, we've traditionally been interested in a much richer notion of agency, according to which agents are entities that act rather than merely behave, where act means does something for a reason, or act refers to intentional action, if you like. So on this notion, then, agency is intimately linked with practical reasoning, that's to say, with working out how best to achieve one's ends, and with instrumental rationality, and so requires a certain psychological architecture. So that's a richer notion of agency, according, and in that sense, then, not so many biological entities obviously would be literal agents in the sense of intentional agents. So we have the minimal notion of agency, an entity that does something, the philosophical notion of intentional agency, according to which humans are the paradigm intentional agents. But then intermediate between those, we have the notion that we find in AI of an intelligent agent, which basically means anything that perceives or senses its environment and then performs actions that alter the environment. So basically anything that exhibits sufficient flexibility, goal-directedness, and autonomy in its behavior, which I think of as a notion of agency with much weaker psychological requirements. And another intermediate notion of agency in between the minimal notion and the full notion of intentional agent is the notion we find in economics, in the rational actor model, in which we define an agent, or rational agent at least, as one whose behaviors satisfy certain consistency conditions. So then they behave as if they're trying to maximize a utility function. So those are the four notions of agency that I find at work in philosophy and science. The most minimal notion, the philosopher's notion of agency as intentional action, the AI notion of agency as exhibiting flexible or goal-directed behavior, and the economist's notion of agency as rational choice. So that's my taxonomy of notions of agency. And when it comes to agential thinking in biology, I think we find aspects of each of them at work, sometimes in a literal sense and sometimes in a more metaphorical sense. So with regard to your question of whether agency is necessarily rational agency, I think not, although I do think in the paradigm cases that we're familiar with from humans at least, I'm persuaded by the line of argument that we get from Davidson and Dennett and many others that we can't sensibly apply intentional descriptors to the organism without diagnosing a fair degree of rationality, a fair degree of coherence in their intentions and consistency between their chosen actions and their beliefs and their desires.
Okay, so I some of that seems to turn on what one considers to count as having a reason, I suppose. So just to go back to the example from Dretzky that you mentioned, the rat, moving its paw. I'm not sure if you would say, it had a reason to move the paw.
I think Dretzky is after something much more basic, and that's just whether the cause of the motion is internal to the entity or not.
Correct. Absolutely.
Which is a very, very sort of hard to make precise distinction for one, but also a very sort of basic distinction, and I think one that would be applicable to inanimate objects as well.
Right. And so what I was getting at was the minimal notion that you mentioned is perfectly acceptable for, a robot, mm-hmm. Of some sort of,
right.
A vacuum cleaner, for example. Mm-hmm. Whereas, a rat or even a bee or something like that, that they seem to have a bit, a bee does seem to act for reasons. So this is the thicker notion, but there seems to be something different you seem to want to say that there's something still different between, say, the Roomba that that, you know, that behaves or that has some sort of minimal agency, and the human who has this somehow very thick notion of reasons, and then there's the bees and the rats and all that, and they're kind of, well, it's heuristic, but it's not heuristic.
Right.
Yeah.
So, as I said earlier, I'm trying to stay neutral with respect to the question of whether intentional and psychological attributions to most non-human organisms are better thought of as metaphorical or literal, although I incline towards the metaphorical, particularly when you're dealing with things without nervous systems or with only rudimentary nervous systems. I mean, with regard to the idea that a bee acts for reasons, I suspect that many sort of traditional analytic philosophers would dispute that and would say something like, no, there is a reason why the bee acts that way in the sense of an evolutionary rationale, but it's not that the bee has a mental representation of that reason. And that I think is also what I would want to say. So one thing I did in the final third of the book, when I talk about evolution and rationality, is to argue that it's a mistake to equivocate between or to equate there being an evolutionary reason why a particular behavior is found in a particular organism and that behavior necessarily being rational, if you like, in the sense of conforming to principles of rational choice.
Well, can we maybe turn directly to the, you know, relationship
yeah.
between rational? We've sort of, you know, edged our way in there.
Okay, this is the final third of the book.
Exactly.
Now.
So you, let me just ask specifically, you know, you look at the, you know, the linkages between rationality and adaptive behavior and how they intersect in basically two different ways. One is that, you know, rationality is on the one hand an outcome of selection, right? I mean, we are evolved creatures and we are, you know, admittedly rational, at least sometimes. But the relation of its relation to adaptation is less clear, which is kind of interesting. So I want you to go into that. But then there's also this other aspect that we have been talking about of using rationality concepts to explain adaptation. So could you, you know, explain each of those linkages?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this gets quite complex. And what I was really trying to do is sort of see a path through the forest here myself, in that there's, I think, long been an idea abroad in the literatures on evolution of behavior that there's some sort of correspondence or connection between adaptive behavior and rational behavior. By adaptive behavior, we mean behavior that has evolved because it benefits an organism's fitness in the simple paradigm case. And by rational behavior, we mean either what philosophers traditionally mean by rational behavior that's suitably based on reasons, on typically on beliefs and desires, or rational behavior in the somewhat weaker sense of economics and rational choice, according to which we mean behavior that satisfies certain consistency constraints, certain axiomatic constraints. And so what I was trying to do is to say something about why these two notions may correspond to each other to the extent that they do and what the connection is. And as you say, my starting point is just the simple observation that there are two dimensions to this connection. Because on the one hand, rational behavior, or at least the cognitive prerequisites for it, are presumably an outcome of natural selection itself. That's to say, natural selection eventually led to creatures such as ourselves and perhaps other animals too, who are capable of engaging in rational behavior in either of those two senses, whether or not we do it all the time or as often as we should. So that's the first dimension. And the second dimension relates back to agential thinking. And this is the fact that we routinely draw on rationality concepts to theorize about and explain adaptive behavior. And so I was interested in why, in these two different ways of thinking about the connection between evolution and rationality and how they might link up with each other.
Okay, so regarding the first one, right? So one of the things that you, I want to explore that a little bit more. So what one of the, to me, really interesting, you know, arguments that you go through in the book is that the relationship between selection and adaptation is weaker than many of us, you know, I'm perfectly fine to include myself, is much weaker than is typically assumed.
Yeah, that's right.
Could you walk us through that a little bit? Because that's a very interesting sort of, you know, argument that you're making. Yeah.
I mean, so at some level that is a, could be, someone might say, look, that isn't that a commonplace that natural selection doesn't necessarily lead to adaptation. However, it's typically, at least in philosophy, I think perhaps less in evolutionary theory itself, it's typically thought that the only reason for that is the existence of constraints. So obviously, if the variation from which selection can choose is heavily constrained, or if non-selective forces intrude or overwhelm natural selection, then we don't necessarily expect to see adaptive outcomes. But that way of setting it up almost presupposes that in the absence of constraint, natural selection does lead to adaptation. But I think that despite the prevalence of that viewpoint, both in biology and without, I think that it isn't really true in that when we delve into the details of evolutionary theory and we go beyond the sort of simplest models, and particularly when we look at the modern theory of frequency-dependent selection, then we find counterexamples to the thesis that natural selection leads to adaptation. So, I mean, clearly, if we think of the simplest, most paradigmatic form of natural selection, according to which there exist a number of phenotypic alternatives in a population, which can be ordered by their fitness. And then we think of natural selection as a process in which the best one is chosen and fixed in the population. Then clearly, natural selection will lead to the best or most adaptive variant being fixed in the population. But of course, that simple model is inapplicable for a number, not universally applicable for a number of reasons. I mean, one is that the fittest phenotype obviously may not breed true, so we ignore the process of inheritance and of sexual reproduction. And another is that simple argument presupposes that the selective value or the fitness value of each type is just a fixed property of it, and so therefore ignores the phenomenon of frequency dependence. And when we take both of those two into account, then we see that we find that what I claim modern evolutionary theory suggests is that there's no theoretical principle to the effect that natural selection will lead to adaptation. Now, that's just a sort of reading of what I see the modern theory of evolution telling us. And the reason I'm interested in it is that I think it bears directly on this question of the relation between the two sorts of agential thinking. That's type one, in which the agent is the evolved organism, and type two, in which the agent is Mother Nature. Because agential thinking of type two is a way of thinking about the process of natural selection. Agential thinking of type one is a way of thinking about the product of natural selection, that's to say the evolved organisms that we find. And when we realize that the phenomena, that the process of natural selection and the phenomenon of phenotypic adaptation are linked more contingently, if you like, and not as a matter of theoretical necessity than has often been thought, then we open up the gap between the two sorts of agential thinking, and we realize why it could be legitimate to apply the organism as rational agent heuristic as a way of understanding adaptation, while rejecting the idea that the process of natural selection can always be usefully analogized to a process of rational choice between alternatives. So that's the significance of me delving into the question of what the link is between selection and adaptation, that on the face of it is a sort of classic question in evolutionary biology, but I argue is a direct reflection of the question I'm interested in, of which is the link between these two, one of the questions I'm interested in, which is the link between my two types of agential thinking.
Right. Good. Good. Well, you just mentioned rational choice theory, and you said at the very beginning, there's sort of two aspects to your philosophical life, or at least two anyway, you know, the philosophy of biology, but also the economics and rational choice. We haven't really talked much about rational choice theory or, you know, utility maximization or any of those sort of concepts, you know, strictly from, well, I don't know if I should say strictly, but, you know, from that, you know, that area of economics of modeling rational choice. Maybe, you know, just can you tell us something about, you know, the relationship you see between ideas, again, of adaptive fitness and then of utility maximization in rational choice theory?
Yeah. So I was talking about the connection between adaptation and rationality, and I was talking about the interesting connection noted by many authors between the fitness maximizing paradigm in evolutionary biology and the utility maximizing paradigm in rational choice theory. And this then suggests that if, insofar as agential thinking is to be applicable to evolved behavior, we would need adaptive behavior in the sense of fitness maximizing behavior to correspond to rational behavior in the sense of utility maximizing behavior when utility is suitably defined in terms of biological fitness. And I sketched a simple little model in which that isomorphism between fitness and utility works nicely. However, in chapter 6, I then come on to investigate a series of arguments, some found in the behavioral ecology literature, some in the economic theory literature, some in philosophy of science, all of which suggest that in certain possibly contrived cases, models can be constructed in which the adaptive and the rational part ways, in the sense that the behavior that we find evolving by natural selection and which qualifies as adaptive behavior actually involves violation of norms of rational choice. For example, involves intransitive choices being made, or involves violation of time consistency and intertemporal choice, or violation of expected utility maximization in choice under uncertainty, which I think is a highly interesting phenomenon. And what I'm doing in that chapter is sort of surveying this large area of theoretical work and then standing back and saying, well, what does it really show? Now, of course, these models have been deliberately designed to precisely to produce that separation between adaptiveness and rationality. And so there's a question about how robust and how general this phenomenon is. But I think as a theoretical possibility, it's very interesting because it shows that there's no a priori guarantee that adaptive behavior will correspond to rational behavior where the latter is independently defined as conformity to standard principles or standard norms of rational choice theory. And this possibility that adaptiveness and rationality can part ways, I think of as indicating a limitation on agential thinking type one, in that it shows that in these circumstances, which admittedly may be relatively rare in that the theoretical models are rather sort of contrived, behavior that's adaptive may not correspond to behavior that's rational. And so if we try and apply the organism as rational agent idea to understand what we see, we won't be able to, if you like, despite the behavior being adaptive and having evolved by natural selection. So this then, I think, is a concrete illustration of why it is that the organism as rational agent heuristic, or what I call agential thinking type one as applied to behavior, is not always a heuristically defensible or valuable construct, despite its many advantages.
Okay. I mean, I would love to follow that up and continue our discussion, but we are running out of time. And I'd like to end with a question about your next step in terms of your research. Are you following up this book or turning to other things? What's next for you?
Well, most recently, I've been writing a little short introductory book about philosophy of biology in Oxford University Press's very short introduction series. That's all done now, so I'm turning back towards research. Not really sure is the honest truth. I mean, I'm still interested in all of the themes in this book, and I by no means do I think that my treatment is definitive or that there's nothing more to say. On the contrary, just actually rereading the book for this interview made me realize that I'd like to go back and probe some of these points more, or find a better way of expressing this or that point. So I would like to revisit these issues again and to build further. However, I do think that pragmatically, as probably many people who write academic books will tell you, when you finish a book, then you need to sort of step back and leave it aside for a bit and work on something else, which is what I intend to do for the next couple of years, although what exactly, I don't know yet.
Okay, very good. Well, we're out of time, but I did want to say it's been wonderful talking with you and exploring at least some of the many interesting themes in your book.
Not at all. Thank you very much, Carrie, and thanks in particular for the excellent questions you asked. It really, really helped to focus the discussion.
You've been listening to my interview with Samir Okasha, Professor of Philosophy at University of Bristol. We've been talking about his new book, Agents and Goals in Evolution, which is just out from Oxford University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.